versus Federal Insurance Company.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Steve Hale. I'm here for Phillips. The district court first construed the G2 complaint in its order on the duty to defend early in the case, and after reconsideration held very plainly that the G2 complaint did in fact state a claim for disparagement under the Lanham Act, prong 2. The case then went quiet for a period of time because
wasn't that for purposes of duty to defend?
It was, Your Honor. But
that's different than indemnity, right?
Not on this point, Your Honor.
Why not?
We concede, in fact, I've argued many times that the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. But in both cases, you still must have a complaint that alleges the claim. On the duty to defend, you presume the inferences for the policyholder. If there's any chance of proof of the claim, then they get the defense. That's what Judge Rothstein ruled. That's correct. When it gets time to look at the indemnity, you have to prove indemnity. But in this situation, because we settled the indemnity claim, the underlying claim, Luria and Nordstrom say that you must presume that the settlement expunged that risk and that element of the claim is not retried. So in looking at indemnity, the court still must construe the complaint. Does it, in fact, allege a claim? Yes.
Well, Mr. Hill, you know, you've given us an awful lot of what back and forth in the district court. It really doesn't concern us. But as I read the Gillette complaint, and maybe I'm wrong, but it seemed to me the Gillette complaint alleges ads that were run in 97 and 98. Is that true?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I didn't understand. The Gillette complaint
alleges ads that were run in 1997 and 1998. Is that true?
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's what the settlement covered. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. It covers more ads. Because
why?
The Gillette complaint says, among others, in all instances.
So the only ones listed in 1997 and 1998.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
All right. So that's what the settlement covered. We look at the allegations.
But
the Nordstrom case tells us we look at the allegations.
Right. And the allegations, Your Honor, says, and among others.
Can you tell me where this is in the record?
Yes, sir. The complaint, I can't give you the ER pages, but I can tell you the paragraphs of the complaint. I can read them to you. It's at ER 43.
That's
I now see that. I do have 43 and 44. Paragraph 6 says, Optiva makes its Sonic and Beyond the Bristles claim in the following ways, comma, among others. And it lists those specific examples in the attaches.
What page are we on?
ER 43, Your Honor.
43. I've got ER 42, and it skips to ER 45.
Oh, my gosh. Catch 22 always gets you.
43 and 44 aren't in the complaint. You provided us with this, didn't you?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I got my copy from our copy of the record just, you know, yesterday as I put my book together.
All right. Now, I'm on 43.
Optiva makes it Sonic and Beyond the Bristles claims in the following ways.
Again, possibly among others.
No, there's no word possibly. It says among others.
Well, no, it says possibly right here. 6A, possibly among others.
6A. Look at
6A.
This.
Of course it's possibly it.
Well, that's because they are saying we're not sure where all you read the Titanic at.
Possibly.
But, Your Honor, I think the point on 6 is the Titanic ad is among other ads. 6A.
No, you can read it that way. You could read it that Optiva makes its claim in the following ways, among others, and it's talking with respect to this ad. And then specifics, but there could be other specifics with respect to this ad.
It's very
I suppose you can read it that way, Your Honor, but all the inferences, of course, go to us on the summary judgment issue. But the record is absolutely clear that as this case developed, Gillette came forward with 340 separate ads.
No, but we're told from Nordstrom's, we look at the allegations.
Yes.
and the allegations say 97 and 98.
The allegations, I just have to differ with Your Honor, because I read it as saying.
Where does it say any other date?
Six doesn't purport to limit the complaint to 97, 98. They say these kinds of ads have been made by Optiva in the marketplace in these ads, among others.
That's a fantastic argument. When the point is so clear in giving dates and specifications, you say somewhere back there might be other things, but there aren't any other things.
Well, there are, Your Honor, because they spent several years, and Optiva spent $7 million defending the claim, and they fought about 340 ads.
Yeah, but weren't they sued already for the other ads?
There was a G1 case that had some of these ads in them. Close to trial of G1 in the Southern District of New York, Gillette asked to amend. The trial judge says too late, and so Gillette filed G2. It got put on hold until G1 got tried. When that case was completed, G2 got going. Our coverage case was put on hold until G2 was concluded. It concluded by settlement. At the time, there were 340 ads being argued about. Magistrate Freeman had addressed the scope of discovery, not the scope of the complaint, had said that discovery should be limited until the complaint's amended. Gillette was going to amend the complaint. The parties got serious and settled the claim.
It wasn't amended.
It was not.
So there's no amendment going into what possibly might have been in other things. So we look at the allegations. Nordstrom is very clear precedent for that.
I believe that's the case, Your Honor, but I would argue in interpreting Nordstrom that even if we take the view that Your Honor is announcing here, that when you settle the case, you settle the claims that are alleged in the complaint. No question about that. But when you look to see what is in those claims, you can look at the other parts of the record. It is completely incongruous with reality to say that we didn't settle all the claims. There were 340 ads, excuse my voice this morning, at issue. It was a very vigorously disputed case, as these big manufacturer land that case.
Did the settlement agreement identify the ads that were in?
All ads, Your Honor. Every ad, every claim, major could have been made up to that point. Very inclusive. And I think, Your Honor, for the purposes of determining what we settled, we can't read out of this case among others, because the reality of the case is there were many others, and I'm sure the trial bench wouldn't want to see a complaint that attached 340 ads. That's not the kind of pleading rules we have. They were very careful to include some ads as an illustration, and they attached some of those ads to the complaint. So there's no question about what the complaint.
We have some law that says we look at the actual settlement agreement. We're trying to follow precedent.
I think indirectly, Your Honor, I think even Nordstrom and Luria say this, because they say what was settled. And the settlement agreement describes what was settled. Now, I would agree if we actually settled, for example, a patent infringement claim along with this, and we weren't sued for that, I think there's a much stronger argument that you can't say that that was part of what you settled for the purposes of coverage.
Is the district court just wrong when she says that Phillips' actual liability to Gillette was frozen at the time of settlement by what was then in the complaint?
If you say, put a few more modifiers in that sentence, Your Honor, say Phillips' potential liability under the G2 complaint as pled, unamended, was as it was at the time of settlement. I would agree with that. But
they hadn't amended it.
Your Honor, think if the court adopts that in a affirmance of the district court's ruling, then what you're going to have to say to all the litigants is, but I've got this insurance out here. if I don't settle this case, there's going to be an amendment, and there'll be a trial, and we can spend another $7 million, which was the projection for the additional defense costs through trial, and I'll get my insurance. Or you force the litigants to say, I might settle with you, but you're going to have to amend your complaint first to put these other claims in, which you might not.
What's wrong with that?
Pardon me? It's contrived.
What's wrong with that?
I think it's contrived, Your Honor.
Well, then, I mean, you're trying to settle the case. You say, I can settle with you if you amend your complaint. It's rather easy. But what's the problem with that?
I think that introduces into the settlement process factors in some cases that could inhibit the conclusion of settlement.
Why?
Because you're driving toward a conclusion to settle these particular things.
You explain to them, you need the insurance. You know the law of the circuit. The state doesn't know it's from. We're not adopting a new rule. We're following a precedent.
And I understand that, Your Honor.
Precedent when you settle the case.
But let me just say this, if I may, please. Assuming that you decide that I lose everything that we've been talking about so far, which would disappoint me, but, you know, those things happen. We do, in fact, have other ads that are in the settlement. Those ads are clearly identified in the complaint, specifically and attached. Those are among the things we settled. So, with all due respect to district court, we fail to see how the court can conclude that Optiva, and it was then Phillips that acquired them, didn't settle the prong to Lanham Act claims expressed in 19, 21, 22, and 17, supported by the factual allegations of 167 and the attached ads of the Titanic ad. I mean, without any question, from my humble perspective, this is a classic quintessential prong to Lanham Act claim in paragraphs 17, 19, 21, and 22. And there are specific allegations in 6 and 7 of specific ads using exclusively incomparable language, which state, again, from my perspective, beyond a reasonable doubt, a classic quintessential disparagement claim. We settled those, even if the other ads aren't in. But returning for a moment to the prior questions, what if this complaint didn't have paragraphs 6 and 7? The complaint simply said you have engaged Optiva in unfair advertising. That advertising has disparaged our Braun Oral-B product. It has diminished that product in the eyes of the consumers, as this complaint says, and there was no ad specified. How would the court ever then decide what you settled? You would decide it by going to the actual case. I mean, I'm not contriving what was settled.
That's a wonderful hypothetical, but we don't have it.
No, but we have it all the time, because the pleading rules throughout the nation, federal court, state court, says, don't give me a 75-page complaint. This is notice
pleading. Basic notice pleading, you read a complaint very liberally.
I'm sorry.
Notice pleading, you're correct.
Yes.
And you look at the allegations very generously.
Yes. And then we settled. I mean, this is not like a contrived settlement. This was a very hard-fought case. And they sat down and they did business, finally, after years and years and millions of dollars. They did what Washington law wants them to do, settle the case. And then there's catch-22, because we want to read out, among others. They were there in spades. And in fact, the record was for the district court, because that was all submitted.
Before you sit down,
Yes, sir.
I want to ask you one question about the change in the text of the policy.
Yes.
There was an ongoing relationship here.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes. In fact, Federal was the first insurer of Optiva. It was a new company. They had a policy. There were two policies, 3 years each, 6 years.
And for the first 3 years of their relationship, the policy included the language of disparagement.
Yes, Your Honor.
In the fourth year, the policy language changes.
Yes, Your Honor. That issue was briefed to the court.
Do you think that Admiral, or Federal, I guess it's here, was, you know, there was a change, I mean, a significant change was contemplated by that?
I can't say what was in their mind, Your Honor. We didn't have that discovery. But I can say that this whole issue of which, what that difference means, if anything, under Washington law, was briefed to the court early on. The court held all policies cover disparagement, applying the Kitsap County case.
This is de novo now, so.
Pardon me?
This is a de novo review.
But that issue wasn't appealed, Your Honor. We didn't brief it. It wasn't, they filed no cross appeal. The issue on appeal is whether whether the complaint states a claim for disparagement and whether we settled that claim. I believe it's that narrow. I mean, we're happy to brief the other one. We won it once. I think we can win it again. It's just not today.
All right.
Before you sit down, I should tell you.
Do I sense like I'm running?
I wanted to tell you that I had taken out 43 and 44. It came back to me. Those were the key pages. That's why I was surprised. So nobody on your staff failed to put them in.
Right.
I just removed them. And
thank you.
I just came to my rescue. So.
I'd like to reserve some time, please.
You may. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Chris Neal, and I represent Federal Insurance Company, appellee in this matter. Preliminarily, I'd like to correct 2 points made by Phillips Counsel. One is with regard to the scope of the settlement agreement. If you turn to ER 303 regarding scope, the particular part I want to draw your attention to is that all the claims that were raised in the G2 complaint were settled. There are no reference that I can see that claims that makes any reference to the ads, and I wanted to make that clear. The second point I wanted to make concerning what Mr. Hale said had to do with the judge's order on the duty to defend, where she discussed the change that Judge Baez mentioned in the two policies, between the earlier policies and the late policies. In the duty to defend, yes, she did hold that libel could be interpreted for the purpose of duty to defend. But in her order on summary judgment, which is before this Court, she clarified her situation with respect to indemnity and concluded that there would be coverage under the earlier policies potentially for ads containing claims that were disparaging that were run in the 93 to 96 period, but not afterwards. Before I begin, I wonder if the panel has any questions for me based on what Mr. Hale has told you.
Don't you read this complaint liberally?
Do I personally?
No.
Okay.
Under the rules.
I think that is, that's probably Washington law, Your Honor, yes.
So if you read it generously, why doesn't that inure to their benefit?
Because I don't see any disparagement in there. I don't see, well, under their definition of disparagement, to belittle, to downgrade, to slight, I don't see where Phillips ads are alleged by Gillette to have belittled, slighted, or downgraded the Gillette product. I don't see the factual support for that, and neither did Judge Rothstein.
Well, this one little ad that they attach, you know, this Titanic, and if you go to the second page, then this ad is attached to the complaint, at least to my version of the complaint. I don't know how many ads were attached to the complaint, but
I think 6 or 7. I think you're talking about ER 53, Your Honor.
And 50, yes, ER, and I'm specifically talking about ER 54.
Okay.
And they have this little chart. There's gum disease causing germs below the gum line decrease. Over 60% by using Sonic Care, but increase over 60% by using Braum Oral B.
Oh my God. That sounds like disparagement to me,
that,
Judge.
Isn't that disparagement?
And it sure did, and it sure sounded like disparagement to Gillette when they filed that claim in Gillette 1, an entirely different suit. That claim is what was at issue, and that's why we had a duty to indemnify Gillette 1. They brought to the Court's attention in Gillette 1 that Phillips had run these ads saying if you use the Gillette product, you're going to get gum disease. And that certainly is product disparagement. And, in fact, so much so that there was a jury verdict against Phillips on that very point, and they had to pay a significant amount of money. They came to Federal for indemnity, and sure enough, because there was product disparagement as a result of this ad, and possibly a couple of others, we indemnified them. The difference in Gillette One was the main event, if you will, and then as they proceeded through that litigation, they concluded, they being Gillette, that we didn't get everything in that we wanted to get in. We need to amend. Well, it was too late in the litigation, and the federal judge there didn't let them amend. They filed a separate lawsuit for the remaining claims on the same ads that they had failed to identify or include in their original complaint in G1.
Couldn't you say that these ads run in the 78 period or 98 period, whatever? What are we talking about? 98?
I believe these ads all ran in the 98 period, but at this point, I'm not prepared to say that expressly to the court because there are, you know, there potentially at one time there were 341 ads with several iterations. So I think with respect to the ads that are attached, you're right.
So couldn't you have a continuing product disparagement claim that began, you know, a new one that begins in 98 that was not covered in the earlier litigation?
I think potentially you could if you had a policy that would provide coverage.
That gets us back to how you then interpret the policy.
Exactly. Or it could get us back to your Admiral case saying we could talk about prior publication.
Well, your co-counsel there, or your opposing counsel there, said that you didn't challenge the district court's interpretation.
No. Her interpretation, if you're talking about the difference between the two policies, I'm in complete and total agreement with it with respect to her duty to indemnify, which is the issue before this panel. I didn't have a problem with it on the duty to defend. I think you do have to be ultra expansive when you look at the duty to defend, but when you settle it, when you are talking about the duty to indemnify, you're talking about indemnifying the insured for the claims it actually settled, and things begin to narrow down a bit at that point. So I'm in complete agreement with her order. I saw no need for a cross appeal. I think she did a good job.
So, I mean, in your – well, how do you interpret does slander or libel include product disparagement?
I think there are various forms of defamation. There are defamation against the person, and you've got slander and libel. That's not at issue here. If you go through their briefing, they being Phillips, you don't find any – I think libel has gone by the boards. You get into other kinds of defamation, including disparagement or defamation of another's product.
Isn't it liable to say that that Phillips made false and misleading statements?
Not if there's no factual support, Your Honor. What if Phillips had taken the position in its advertising that the Gillette toothbrush is a green toothbrush, but in fact Gillette's toothbrush was blue? What you have is a false and misrepresentation about the Gillette product, but you don't have a disparagement of that product. It's not disparaging to say something.
The policy covered libel and slander, didn't it?
Both sets of policies cover libel and slander of Gillette.
Can't some of these allegations be read to be libelous or slanderous of alleging that Phillips made libelous and slanderous comments?
And I think I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. Judge Rothstein addressed that very issue when she addressed the coverage on Gillette One. You can have a degree of product disparagement that is so severe that it begins to impugn the character and quality of the manufacturer of the product. And the Wachter, I believe it's the Wachter case from Eastern Washington, comes to mind. And there was an advertisement in that case in which a competitor said, in essence, don't buy his milk. His trucks don't keep the milk at the proper temperature. Well, that implied that there was a health and safety question with respect to that milk manufacturer, and that's trade disparagement that rose to the level of libel, and that's exactly why Judge Rothstein found in Gillette 1 that the ad that Judge Baez mentioned rose to the level of libel for Phillips' libel of Gillette. So that's been addressed, but it doesn't exist in G2.
I don't know why not, though.
Because
how could the G1 complaint resolve all publication of the ads that occurred subsequent?
Because there's been a jury verdict on all of those ads that has been entered, and they've already had to pay. Well, or even indemnified for all of that.
Were they? Well, what if that doesn't make? Well, suppose they just keep running the ads. You know, they just keep running them. Who cares?
I suppose
again. I mean, Gillette could sue again. More damages.
They didn't
compensate it up until the time of the jury verdict, but you ran them again, and now you've harmed us again. So we're entitled to more damages.
As Judge Noonan says, that's an excellent hypothetical, but it's not our facts here.
You look at the complaint. What's alleged in the complaint?
The complaint simply talks about false misrepresentations about Philips' own product. There's no mention of Gillette's product. There is no disparagement of Gillette's product in the complaint. And these ads that you're talking about were addressed in G1, a completely different lawsuit. It's been resolved.
Let me ask you this, another issue. When you look at what was actually settled, is it fair at all to look at the settlement agreement or?
Oh, yes.
It is. Is there a Washington case that says that?
No. I think that if I, as the insurer, am going to take the position that I'm only going to indemnify for what you settled, I want to see the complete picture of what you settled. Any case that says that? No. But I want to see what you wrote down, and I want to see how it compares to the complaint, and I want to see the factual support for the complaint, including attachments thereto. Ideally, I'd like to see what went on in discovery as well. I'd like to get a full picture of what went on in the litigation. Because we're only going to indemnify for the claims that they settled that fall within the coverage of our policy. And that requires that we look at the settlement to see if there is any part of it that is potentially indemnifiable in any degree.
Well, we said in Nordstrom's interpreting Washington law that we may only consider the claims actually settled, which are defined by the allegations in the complaint. So you seem to be suggesting that it's not only could we look at the allegations in the complaint.
No, you asked me what an insurance company would do when considering to indemnify its insured.
Well, I'm asking you, is this, in light of what we said in Nordstrom's, is it also fair for us, for the court, to look at a settlement agreement, for example?
I'd be disingenuous to say.
To determine what claims were actually settled in the complaint.
I would be disingenuous to say otherwise, Your Honor, because I cited a case in support of my capacity or ability to use the Gillette testimony that says that you look at everything. I understand what Nordstrom says. As an insurer, I agree with the Sherman case that talks about the need to bring it all in and have a look at it and sort it out. Now, whether a court looks at it differently, that's a different issue, I think.
I remember, you know, taking up on Judge Noonan's point about why didn't you just wait, why didn't you have him amend the complaint to broaden the scope of the allegations. You know, in district court, when we used to do settlements, I used to, the parties often would say, well, we wanted it to be clear that this is what we've settled for purposes of, you know, insurance coverage. And, you know, we all sort of just blinked our eyes. And I'd tell them, whatever, if you can legitimately and honestly put in your settlement agreement, I'm not going to block you. That was all done for the purposes of settlement and to allow one party or the other to seek indemnity from the insurance company. So, you know, I always kind of assumed that you would look at the terms of the settlement agreement to see what claims were actually settled.
I would, but you don't want to limit your inquiry to that, I think, because you run into collusive settlement issues
right. Where
coverage is manufactured in the course of that. And I think Mr. Hale's briefing, if not at the appeal stage, possibly before, alluded to the fact that potentially you could have a problem with that, with driving insurers to do that. But I don't think that impacts the duty to indemnify that's before this panel today, the possibility that an insured could be inclined to do that. That's between the insured and the carrier on a breach of contract issue, I think, perhaps a fraud issue.
Thank you, counsel.
I have just a few more minutes, Your Honor. I'd like to address
you. You don't need to fill up minutes. I mean, if you have a particular point you want to make that you haven't made, but you don't need to just use up all your time.
I wanted to remind the Court that Phillips has failed to meet its burden under Celotex, and that there is no disparagement in the complaint. And with that, I will leave.
I think you've made those arguments. Thank you.
Most brief. The scope of the settlement, Your Honor, on ER 303, paragraph 2 says scope. It says the agreement settles the action captioned as, et cetera. And then down further in the paragraph, and all claims that are raised or asserted therein. It doesn't say only the ads listed in the complaint. It says we have settled the action and the allegations and all matters that are raised or asserted therein. So the among other comes into play. Certainly the 340 ads that were on the table that were being vigorously litigated are in the scope of the complaint.
Now, are those ads somewhere on the record?
Yes, sir, they are. The Federal put all the ads in. When we moved for summary judgment, not thinking we needed to burden the Court with all of them, we put in some ads in each of the policy years. That led to the order saying we'd establish a prima facie case, which incidentally must include the finding that the complaint alleged disparagement, or we never had a prima facie case. Secondly, I want to emphasize.
Yes, sir, your cover letter sending the settlement agreement, providing settlement agreement, has a couple of things that I'm not sure if they're in the record. You've got. Number 3, this is ER 297, Gillette counsel letter indicating Gillette's damage claim. Do we have that?
It's not a page I put in my notebook, Your Honor, and I don't know how to respond to that question, I'm afraid.
Could we get that?
Can you get it?
Yes, from you.
Oh, you may certainly get that, Your Honor.
Would you provide it?
I most certainly will. Did you write those pages down? Thank you.
Number 2, the estimates of the cost to take the case with trial. There are a number of things that you list in that cover letter which somehow didn't make it into the record as far as I can see, even though I may be wrong.
I don't think the $7 million is in the record, Your Honor. I represent
I would like
that to
ask
the Court.
You to provide the things that you list in your letter there on ER-297.
We'll do that, Your Honor. Thank you very much. Secondly, on the Titanic ad, that was in G1 and in G2 both. But in G2, the Titanic ad would have gone into evidence to the jury. They would have looked at the full context of the ad, and the Sony claims that are on that page that are quoted in the complaint are exclusively and comparative claims. And the case authorities we've submitted, including Your Honor's opinion in Southland Sod Farms, clearly hold that you can have impliedly truthful claims that still mislead and deceive. For example, Braun claimed, Gillette claimed, that their product also did the below the gum line thing. So Optiva's ad could have been correct after their own technology, but could have misled based on consumer surveys that would have been given to the G2 jury that Gillette's brush did not go below. So there is plenty that Gillette complained about on the Titanic ad that was not part of G1. Secondly, G1 and G2 are not a timing thing. G2 was the main event. G2 was a bet the company case. G1 was a small case. But they overlap.
You just said G1 was the main event.
It's absolutely not correct, Your Honor. I mean, G2 was a bet the company claim. $100 million-type dollars damage potential.
I thought it said $40 million.
Not for G2, Your Honor. I'm not sure that's in the record. I'm making a representation, and I apologize if that's not appropriate. It's not really germane, but it's not.
Well, it says for the post-98 ads, was it approximately 40 million.
But G2 had 6 years of ads, right? Also, libel is not defined in the policy. So even if we're looking at the later ads, libel includes trade libel. Trade libel is disparagement. Kitsap County says we get the benefit of that.
So that's the only question I have, though, is if they specifically deleted product disparagement and for the 97 and 98, or for policies issued after 96, isn't it, wouldn't it be wrong to interpret libel to encompass trade libel? Because then they have an effective, why would you then eliminate the language?
I think, Your Honor, that the language that they took out isn't quite as plain as the language you used in your question. But I get the point. And I think they have to live with what they still sold us. And what they sold us was libel and
not defined.
Exactly. But under Kitsap County, we get a fair reading of that as the average purchaser of insurance would have understood it to be. I'm not sure, frankly, anybody noticed the change in the policy. You know, I mean, that record didn't get developed because until the number 5 order came out, we had the court ruling that all the policies are covered. We saw her change in the number 5 order, planned to address it, but we were out of court.
Well, now, you know, I have great respect for Judge Roth.
I do, too, Your Honor.
And why do you think she changed?
If I can be candid, I don't mean any disrespect. I've had dozens and dozens of cases from Judge Roth. I have the greatest respect for her personally. I know her personally. To me, the number 5 order looked like it was written by a different judge sitting in a different jurisdiction. How can you, on September 12, sign an order that says we have a prima facie case and the burden shifts, and 6 weeks later grant summary judgment when no new issues are raised except the Claire Howe testimony, which we haven't talked about, which I don't think I need to talk about, and she doesn't even mention the prima facie order. On reconsideration, we raise it, and it's still not mentioned. Honestly, I have no idea, except the clerk changed it. I mean, you know, honest to God, I mean,
can you that comment?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
All right. The case of Phillips Oral
Thank
Health
you, Your Honor.
Versus Federal Insurance Company is submitted. We're going to take up Matthews v. Spalding.